traditional way of doing things. It was another feature of the system that's worthy of comment is that Augustus himself was extremely tactful in his administration of power, completely unlike Caesar, who had shown an utter lack of tact in that regard. The title he chose for himself says it all. He wasn't dictator, he wasn't rex, he wasn't dux, which means leader almost in a military sense. He was simply the princeps, the leading citizen. This is a title that had been arrogated by most of the leaders of the late republic. It was entirely innocuous. I am the leading citizen. It doesn't sound oppressive. It doesn't have any hint of autocracy in it. It sort of reminds me of the way that certain despots around the world call themselves presidents, even though they've never, ever experienced having to go before the people for an election. The president is such an innocuous term, but they've been in power for 30 years or more, and they're president of this or president of that nation. Similarly, princeps is very unthreatening type of a term. This is what gave name to the whole system of government, the principate, the system of government by a princeps, by a leader. And this is the word, in fact, that the Romans used to describe emperor. The emperor was the princeps, the leading citizen. Our word prince, of course, derives from that term, princeps. He was very tactful in his consultation of the Senate. He always would consult with them about any legislation he wished to pass or any measure that he wanted to see enacted. Very careful to present himself very much as a peer. He lived modestly in a small house in the Palatine in Rome. He wasn't escorted around by armed guards or anything like that. He behaved like a regular member of the Senate, maintaining a fiction that he was, as he liked to put it, primus inter pares, first among equals. And he was also very careful to try to use his legal powers as rarely as possible. He preferred, wherever possible, to get things done by suggestion. This is by virtue of a quality that Augustus bore, which is really untranslatable into English. The Latin is auctoritas. It's usually rendered into English as authority, but that's rather an anemic rendering of what is a much more complex concept. Auctoritas is a combination of one's prestige and influence, authority, ability to suggest the way things should go. It derives from your birth, from your achievements, from your wealth, from your standing, from your titles and offices. And in this quality, Augustus, of course, far surpassed anyone else in the Roman state. And all he had to do was suggest that, oh, I like that candidate for the consulship this year, and sure enough, the man would be elected. Or he would say, yeah, I'd really like to see a law enacted on this issue, and everyone would go off and make it happen. So he preferred to use this auctoritas, this more intangible quality than his legally defined powers in running the state. Another example of his tact. Ultimately, however, it can't be denied that Augustus's position had been won by force of arms, and that ultimately at the root of his and every other emperor's power lay the swords of the legions. That is a fact that, of course, Augustus did his utmost to disguise in his construction of the constitutional artifice of the principate. It's worth perhaps examining a remarkable document that has come to us from Turkey, but which we know was originally put up in the outside the mausoleum of Augustus, his enormous tomb in Rome, the remains of which can still be seen today. This is an inscription that was put up, we hear, on bronze tablets outside his mausoleum and was written by himself. And it's known as the Res Gestae Divi Augusti, the achievements of the divine Augustus. The copy of it we have has been known since at least the 16th century. It comes from Ankara in Turkey, where it was carved on the walls of a temple dedicated to Roman Augustus in both Latin and Greek. We have fragments from other parts of Turkey, and the suggestion seems to be that this was a widely disseminated document throughout the provinces. Certainly it was to be found in Turkey, so far as we can tell. It's a fascinating document. And it was, at least it claims to have been written by Augustus himself in AD 13, the year before he died. It was updated slightly after his death to include a summary of his achievements. And it is, in some ways, a manifesto for the Augustan regime. It opens up with a summary of his early career, which you'll see when I read it is slightly disingenuous in what it omits. At the age of 19, says Augustus, on my own responsibility and at my own expense, I raised an army with which I successfully championed the liberty of the Republic when it was oppressed by the tyranny of a faction. On that account, the Senate passed decrees in my honour, enrolling me in its order in the consulship of Gaius Pansa and Aulus Hirtius, the consuls of 43 BC, assigning me the right to give my opinion among the consulars and giving me imperium. That's this propertorian grant of power against Anthony in 43. Anthony is described as the head of a faction that was tyrannizing the state. It ordered me as a pro praetor to provide in concert with the consuls that the Republic should come to no harm. In the same year, when both consuls had fallen in battle, the people appointed me consul on Triumvir for the organization of the Republic. Next section. I drove into exile the murderers of my father, avenging their crime through tribunals established by law, and afterwards, when they made war on the Republic, I twice defeated them in battle. That's as much as Augustus says about his early career. No mention of proscriptions, no mention of marching in Rome and taking the state by force, and so on and so forth. He simply freed the state from the liberty of oppression of a faction. About the constitutional settlements, he says as follows. In my sixth and seventh consulships, after I had extinguished civil wars, and at a time when, with universal consent, I was in complete control of affairs, I transferred the Republic from my power to the dominion of the Senate and people of Rome. That's the constitutional settlement of 27. That's his take on it. He gave up what he could have taken by force. For this service of mine, I was named Augustus by decree of the Senate, and so on. He mentions various honours. He doesn't mention the grant of proconsular power, however. He mentions various minor honours that were given to him, shields inscribed with his justice and clemency put up in public places and so forth. All he says about his position in the state is this: after this time, I excelled all in auctoritas, although I possessed no more official power than others who were my colleagues in the several magistracies. So he's very careful to portray his position as that of sort of one magistrate among many, who is simply a person more imbued with auctoritas, more imbued with the quality of influence than his peers. We find no mention of the tribunician power in this document, which was rather unusual. He does mention his expenditures on behalf of the people and on behalf of the army, games he gave, public buildings he erected, amount of grain that he distributed and so forth. And the message is clearly this: I am a person in charge of the state by wish of the Senate and people of Rome. I'm not a autocrat. I'm not a dictator. And my regime is a benevolent one that looks after the interests of the people in the empire.
Lecture 33, The Imperial Succession.
Hello and welcome to Lecture 33 of the History of Ancient Rome, in which we're going to examine the problem of the imperial succession. We saw the last time the establishment by Augustus of a new system of government, the Principate, which is often termed the imperial system by modern scholars. And what I want to do before looking at the succession exactly is examine some of the benefits of this system for the empire. And then we will turn our attention in the latter half of the lecture to the issue of the succession, which was the single greatest problem, at least the single greatest political, internal political problem faced by Augustus and, in fact, all subsequent emperors. At the end of the last lecture, I read you selections from Augustus's res gestae, his achievements as preserved on an inscription from Turkey. And in it, I mentioned that plenty of expenditures were listed. This is, in fact, one of the subtitles of the inscription. That it's a list of his achievements and his expenses, the expenses that he paid out on behalf of the people. This is a cardinal feature of the Principate's claim to legitimacy, is that it is effectively a benevolent form of government, one that is concerned for the welfare of its people. And even though the expenses listed in the text of the Res Gestae itself all concern the population of Rome and of Italy, there's no doubt that in terms of the provincial administration of the empire, the Principate was an enormous improvement on what had come before. Augustus had come to power by means of civil war, and he had, with just cause, claimed that he had extinguished civil wars, and indeed he had, at least for a century. And the period of peace and prosperity and stability that Europe, Western Europe, was now to enjoy was to last the best part of 200 years. It's called, for that reason, the Pax Augusta, or sometimes better known as the Pax Romana, the Peace of the Romans or the Peace of Augustus. That was established by Augustus and gave Europe its longest single period of peace, stability, and unity. It's not hard to see how this happened. Augustus had, as we'd seen, marshalled very carefully his control over the army. He had personal command over all the legions that were constituted the Roman army, some 28 in number, and he administered them through his personally chosen ambassadors, his legates, the people who commanded them in his stead on the ground. But governors as well at this time now came to be answerable to a higher power, whereas in the Republic governors had often used their provinces as a means of getting rich or raising forces or armies to use in their domestic squabbles with their opponents and rivals. Under the Principate, that would not be possible. Legates of Augustus and proconsuls of the Senate usually were sent out for a period of between 3 and 5 years. It depended on local conditions, of course, and the competence of the individual concerned and the trust that that individual had earned from the emperor. And when they were away, any misbehavior or mischievousness in their provinces, the raising of funds, or especially the raising of troops, would easily and immediately be seen as political sedition by Augustus and could have dire consequences. It's not that Augustus went around executing proconsuls or legates, far from it. That was not his style, at least it wasn't the style after the Battle of Actium. But he did exercise a control over the initial choice of people that were sent out. That seemed to have been very effective. And as a result, provincial administration improved enormously. The people of the provinces now began to enjoy benefits of Roman rule instead of being subject to rampant fleecing by extortionate proconsuls. A good example of the sorts of ways that a person could stray is illustrated by the example of Gaius Cornelius Gallus, who was the first prefect of Egypt, the first governor of the new province of Egypt established in 30 BC. The case of Gallus, he didn't seem to have done anything that was in terms of republican behavior was particularly bad or subversive, but in the new order of Augustus, he behaved in a way that was unacceptable. We should examine his case to see why. Gallus, as prefect of Egypt for about 3 years, from 30 through 27 BC, conducted a series of campaigns, as governors had always done in the Roman Republic, against bordering people, against people who were threatening the stability of his province. But he went around putting up statues and inscriptions of himself praising his achievements, laying claim to how many tribes and how many peoples he had subjected in battle, how many towns he captured and so on. This was absolutely standard behavior in terms of the Republic, but it was unacceptable in terms of Augustus's regime. Because here was a man who might present the armies with a confusion in their loyalties. This was not considered the done thing. Gallus basically failed to realize that the world, the political world that he worked in, had radically and irrevocably changed. Augustus, however, did not summon Gallus back, have him put on trial and executed. After all, he hadn't done anything particularly wrong. All he had to do, by virtue of his auctoritas, and this is a real sign of the auctoritas, the influence of Augustus, all he had to do was say, you know, that guy Gallus, he's no longer a friend of mine. Gallus's political and social existence was erased. At that point, he was ostracized by his peers. No longer a friend of Augustus, he was practically dead. And the Senate began lining up to take shots at him. He was going to be charged for mismanagement of his province, extortion and so forth, and to obviate the inevitable conviction and disgrace, he committed suicide. All Augustus had to do was say, he's not my friend anymore. That's real power. That's autoritas in action. But more importantly, it shows the sort of close control that Augustus could exercise over the behavior of his governors. Gallus, after all, had not done anything particularly mischievous or wrong. But so any governor who did try to do something that was definitely politically seditious would have faced serious consequences. So good order, government, stability, and effective, peaceful administration of the provinces came in with Augustus. It's no coincidence that statues and busts of Augustus are by far the most numerous of any of the emperors of Rome found in the provinces, many of them carved and erected years, decades after the man's death. He was and always stood high in the esteem of the provincials. He had founded the Pax Romana, the stability and peace of the Roman state, and brought it to the provinces. And as a result, the Principate was an enormous improvement for the vast majority of the empire's inhabitants. Let's not forget that. We've been so focused on the Roman aristocracy and on the conflicts within it. The vast majority of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire lived on farms out in the provinces. Those people had gone through an awful lot of the civil wars and extortions of the late Republic, and that now was all in the past. Now there was peace, stability, and good government. That alone is a huge achievement of the Principate and of Augustus himself. A chief means of establishing the peace and prosperity of the government, as I mentioned last time and warrants slightly more scrutiny now, is the creation of a standing volunteer army. After the Battle of Actium, Augustus had some 60 legions under his command. He demobilized all but 28 of those, settled the remaining 32 peacefully without mass confiscations by virtue of his having access to the wealth of the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. He then employed the new army, his new army, which of course was swearing loyalty to himself. He employed it in lengthy campaigns all along the Rhine and Danube rivers. He attempted, it seems, to incorporate Germany across the Rhine into his empire, but that came to a bad end in AD 9 when several legions were ambushed and annihilated by a German chieftain who has the wonderful name Herman the German, Arminius in Latin, who had fought as a non-citizen soldier in the Roman army, knew how they fought, and organized his tribesmen to effectively drive them out, ambushed and annihilated several legions in AD 9. That prevented Augustus from incorporating Germany into the Roman Empire and established the Rhine as one of the cardinal points on Rome's northern frontier. He also engaged his armies in the final reduction of the Iberian Peninsula in the northwestern section of the peninsula. So once these armies had been engaged and covered themselves in glory, and of course covered Augustus in glory since he was their commander-in-chief, they were then settled on the frontiers, established in camps far from Rome, away from Italy, as I say, a permanent standing force. This is very different from the Republican military system, where armies were raised in Italy as they were needed. Once an army was, of course, raised in Italy, it could then be used for the political purposes of the general. That threat was now obviated in this new system. The legions were professional force and stationed far from Italy and far from Rome, far from the center of power. And, of course, commanded on the ground by Legati Augusti, legates of Augustus. It's worth noting that the 28 legions, this is quite a remarkable fact, it always strikes me as really quite extraordinary, that the 28 legions of Roman citizen soldiers and a similar number of non-citizen troops called auxiliaries, together numbered perhaps 300 to 350,000 men in control of an empire that stretched from the Atlantic to the Black Sea and incorporated most of Middle East and Egypt. Quite extraordinary. There were also a mass of legislative, cultural, social and economic changes that we just do not have time to go into in this survey course of Roman history. But the Augustan age is well worthy of deeper study, and I do encourage people to read deeper into it. It's a period of tremendous cultural and artistic achievement, as well as social and economic interest as well. So the Principate then did offer many benefits to the Roman Empire. But it had a flaw. It had a flaw at its very core that was generated by the nature of the Principate itself. And this problem was the problem of the succession. Now, the transfer of power from one governing party to another is always a difficult and problematic issue. Most people in Western societies aren't really aware of this. We're used to our governments transferring power peacefully from one to the next. It would be inconceivable to us that a failed presidential candidate would run off to an army camp and appeal to the loyalties of the soldiers, for instance. But this sort of thing has happened all throughout history and still happens in many places. And the Roman Empire is no exception. But the problem of the succession, the general problem of the passage of power, especially in despotic or in autocratic societies, was greatly exacerbated by the way that the Principate was conceived and practiced by Augustus. Let's remember, Augustus had created the artifice that he was really something of a super magistrate. In his res gestae, he claims, "I have no more imperium or no more power than my several colleagues in the various magistracies." All of the powers that he did have in this constitutional construction of Augustus had been given to him voluntarily by the Senate and people of Rome. They had been given to him in temporary packages of 5 and then later of 10 years. As a result, technically, once Augustus was dead, power and governance should have returned to the purview of the Senate, the people, and the annual magistrates, as it had done before Augustus had been given his powers. In other words, there should have been a return to the Republic. But given the mayhem of the late Republic, and as well, let's not forget, given the essentials of Augustus's career and the precedents that were now in play by virtue of his own achievements, coming to power through civil war and having all these tremendous powers created and voted for him. If that had happened, if there had been a return to the Republic, civil war was virtually guaranteed. Army commanders and ambitious senators would want to emulate what Augustus himself had achieved. Something of an irony. On the other hand, since Augustus was just a super magistrate, now a defender of tradition and the old ways, the ways of the ancestors, he could no more designate a successor to himself than could, say, a consul or a praetor or a tribune. To have done that would have smacked of the sort of open autocracy that Augustus was so concerned to conceal from his peers. It also could have proved, of course, lethal to Augustus himself, as it had done to Caesar. He was therefore in something of a bind. What would happen when Augustus died? He had determined, no doubt, early on that the Principate was essential to the successful governance of the state and the continued stability of the state. He had no intention of allowing the Republic to raise its head and cast the Roman world back into the abyss of civil war. At the same time, he had to come up with some form of a system to indicate who would come next. And it had to be done subtly and not too obviously, or else he might excite the fears of the aristocracy and appear overly autocratic. Well, like any good Roman, Augustus harbored ambitions for his own family, and he came up basically with a dynastic principle for the issue of the succession. He couldn't, as I say, he couldn't indicate a successor openly. He couldn't say, this man is henceforth princeps designate. But what he could do is suggest through his autoritas, as he was so used to doing in every aspect of governance, who his favorites were by signs of favor, indications of preference. Now, his machinations over the succession problem are far too labyrinthine and complex and would require close study of Augustus's horribly complicated family tree to fully bring out. So I'll treat them only in general terms and summarize for you what the main modes of preference indication were that Augustus employed in ascending order of importance. Let me look at some examples to illustrate the point. He could bring princes forward at an early age in their development and have the Senate vote them special privileges, especially the privilege of standing for high office in advance of the legally prescribed age, usually 10 years. So if the normal age for standing for the consulship was 42, then the princes that Augustus presented could become consuls at 32. So they'd be younger than anyone else and would therefore stand out. This was done in the case of several of his successors, not least his nephew Marcellus, who was first designated in the period 25 through 23 BC. Princes could also be chosen as his legates to command his armies in various parts of the empire. This had several advantages. Of course, one had a personal family member in control of an army group. That family member could earn military glory for himself. And of course, all military glory that was earned by any segment of the Roman army reflected well on Augustus himself, who was ultimately the commander-in-chief of the whole unit. Princes who were not family members of Augustus, especially immediate family members, could be brought in close to his family through two main mechanisms. Marriage to his only natural child. It's worth stating that he only had one natural child, no sons. He had the daughter Julia, who was married no less than 3 times, and in every instance to a man who was considered to be Augustus' successor to power. So one could marry, so Augustus could marry the chosen prince, if he wasn't already a member of the family, close family, marry that prince to Julia, or he could adopt himself, adopt outsiders or other princes as his own sons, in the same way that he himself had been adopted by Julius Caesar. Several princes either were married to Julia or were adopted by Augustus in the course of his long reign. And the final form of favour, and by far the most decisive, was a grant of a share in the powers of Augustus. A grant of either proconsular imperium, or even more significant, a grant of his tribunicia potestas, of his tribunician power. In some ways, the grant of proconsular power could be seen as sort of a special provincial assignment. I'm going to give you imperium over the east to deal with this problem. Nonetheless, it was significant that any prince was given a share of a section of Augustus's imperium, of his power. But the tribunician power was absolutely unique to Augustus. It had been created for him. It was the power that he exercised, or at least could exercise, in the domestic sphere, in the company of his peers, in the Senate, and in Rome itself. And so a grant of tribunician power, above all else, was a clear sign that the person receiving the grant was a favoured prince. And in fact, in some ways, usually the grant of proconsular power came first, then the grant of tribunician power. In some ways, it was also a fail-safe mechanism. It meant that once a prince had been given some proconsular power and a share of the tribunician power, he was effectively a sub-emperor already. And if anything happened to Augustus, there already was a substitute who would just step forward and continue where he had left off. A good example of this whole system is Augustus' treatment of his friend Agrippa. Agrippa, we have seen, was his right-hand man and had been there with him right from the start, right from his beginning in 44 BC when he came over to Italy from training across the Adriatic to go against Parthia with Caesar. Right from the beginning, Agrippa, his close friend, contemporary, had been there, had served him well throughout his early career, was a very effective general, a naval commander, a great organizer. And Agrippa was a prime candidate then for the succession. On the other hand, Agrippa was of relatively low birth. He was of equestrian status. He was a knight, not a senator, and he was not a member of Augustus's family. Augustus's first inclination was to favor his nephew, Marcellus, who was the younger male relative that he had. But when Augustus fell ill in 23 BC and he came so close to dying on that occasion that he handed over to the consuls and to the people gathered around his bed a list of the state's resources. He took off a signet ring and he gave it to Agrippa, not to Marcellus. Well, this certainly got tongues wagging. Everyone had expected that Marcellus would be taking over, and here it was. Agrippa was the one who got the signet ring. While Augustus didn't die in 23 BC, he recovered. Some dynastic tensions seem to have ensued between Agrippa and Marcellus, who didn't seem to have got on terribly well. And Agrippa went east, but he went east with a grant of proconsular imperium from Augustus. There's little question in my mind that Agrippa did not go east under a cloud, because you don't give a grant of proconsular power and army commands to a person that you don't trust or who you're trying to punish. Marcellus died within a few months in 23 BC of an illness, and Agrippa was recalled from the east in 21. He was married to Augustus' daughter Julia, who had been the wife of Marcellus. When in 18 BC, Augustus had his proconsular and tribunician power renewed, Agrippa was brought in to the fold. He was given a grant not only of proconsular power, but also of tribunician power in that year. So from 18 BC until his death in 12 BC, Agrippa was effectively a sub-emperor with Augustus. Had anything happened to Augustus in these years, Agrippa would simply have stepped forward. But that wasn't all. Agrippa and Julia's marriage was a success. It produced lots of children. And in 17 BC, Augustus adopted the two eldest sons from that marriage as his own sons. In other words, he adopted his natural grandsons as his own sons. His idea seems to have been to designate successors for the third generation of the principate. Agrippa would take over if anything happened to Augustus, and after Agrippa would come Agrippa's own sons and Augustus' adopted sons. How neat and tidy that would have been. Well, to cut a long story short, and not to go into the tremendously complicated details of the succession arrangements of Augustus, Augustus outlived most of his successors. During his lifetime, he marked out five men, clearly and unequivocally, as his successors. His nephew Marcellus died 23 BC. His friend and then son-in-law Agrippa died 12 BC. Agrippa's natural sons and Augustus' adopted sons, Gaius and Lucius Caesar, as they're known, who died respectively in AD 2 and AD 4. And then finally, his stepson, Tiberius, who was, in fact, the man who succeeded in AD 14. Tiberius was the natural son of Augustus' wife, Livia. And the fact that he had survived, and so many people had to die for him to come to power, raised suspicions that Livia had had a hand in ensuring that situation came about. These rumors about Livia are to me perfectly illustrative of the sort of uncertainty engendered by the succession problem. Since the indications that Augustus used were indirect, not crystal clear, it was natural that there would be competition within the family, that there would be groups of supporters of this or that prince to ensure that their candidate would come to power. This caused tremendous problems within Augustus's house. His domestic situation was not happy. And the rumors about Livia are, I think, some of the best examples of this situation. It must be said that the case against her is not proven, because some of the people died in ways that would make it virtually impossible for Livia to have been involved. Agrippa died, for instance, far from Rome in the area of Campania in 12 BC in one of his own villas. How Livia could have caused his death there is almost unimaginable. Lucius died in a boating accident off the south coast of France. And Gaius Caesar died following a wound received while besieging an Armenian town over in the east. So not unless Livia's arms reached east and west several thousand miles, it seems impossible that she could have been involved in any of those deaths. But nonetheless, the rumors persist. The most nefarious and despicable of the rumors about her concerns the fact that she may have, at least in the allegations, may have killed Augustus himself. In his last days, apparently, when he was ill, this despite 50 years of marriage, when he was ill, he would only eat figs that he had picked with his own hand off a tree in the garden of the place that he was staying in southern Italy. The story goes that Livia smeared several of these figs on the tree itself with poison, picked them for Augustus, and offered him some poisoned ones. It's a really despicable and foul suggestion, picked up, of course, by Robert Graves and presented to us in his book, as he always did. He always went for the most sensational possibility in his series, I, Claudius. his series of books on Claudius and Claudius the God. But there's no reason really to suspect that Livia was such an evil black widow as she is presented in that fictional account, or she's rumored to be in some of her sources, not all of them. That, however, she was an important person and exercised considerable influence on Augustus is not to be doubted. That she was smart and cunning and well endowed with guile isn't to be doubted at all. Caligula, for instance, called her Ulysses in petticoats, Ulysses being the Roman equivalent of Odysseus, a hero well known for his craftiness and cunning. But that she was a person who murdered all comers, who blocked the route for her son Tiberius to the throne, is far from proven, and in fact, I would suggest, is almost impossible. But the fact that there are such rumors in our sources is nonetheless very suggestive and illustrative of the sort of problem that the succession presented, not just to Augustus, but to all subsequent emperors. What to do with princes, how to deal with the loyalties of the armies, and to ensure that there was a smooth, unchallenged transfer of power from one emperor to the next. All of these issues were to prove, again and again, difficult for emperors to deal with. And what we'll do in the next lecture is examine how the politics of the first dynasty of Roman emperors following Augustus, the so-called Julio-Claudian dynasty, which stretches from AD 14 to AD 68, covering Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, how the politics, the domestic politics of that dynasty were dominated by the succession problem. And that's what we'll examine next time.
Lecture 34, The Julio-Claudian Dynasty.
Hello and welcome to the History of Ancient Rome and Lecture 34, at which we're going to examine in outline and through the examination of three illustrative episodes, the course of events covered by the Julio-Claudian Dynasty, the first imperial dynasty of Rome. The Julio-Claudian dynasty is so called because it represents a marriage of two major Roman families, patrician families, the Julii on the one hand, as represented by Augustus and his inherited position as the head of the Julian family following his adoption by Caesar, and on the other, the Claudii, a very prominent family, we've seen them actually on several occasions already, as represented by the children of Augustus's wife, Livia, who had formerly been married to a man called Tiberius Claudius Nero, a member of the Claudian family, and had two sons by him. As a result of the marriage of Livia and Augustus, which took place in 39 BC under rather unusual circumstances, Livia was pregnant at the time with Tiberius Claudius' son, and Augustus, then of course Octavian, arranged the marriage, took her away from her husband and married her. But as a result of this marriage, then these two great houses came together, and so the family, the royal family, the first royal family of the Roman Empire was called the Julio-Claudian family as a result. Before embarking on a quick overview of the main events of the Julio-Claudian period and then looking at our three illustrative episodes, it's worth mentioning our sources for the period, which are extremely good and in fact make the Julio-Claudian dynasty the best documented imperial dynasty that we have. Our chief source is the writings of the historian Cornelius Tacitus, possibly the greatest of all the Latin historians, who wrote an account of this dynasty called the Annals. He was writing around the period AD 100 through 120 or thereabouts, and he was possessed of an incisive intelligence and a rather cutting and ironic and sarcastic wit. He wrote a fairly dark and moody account of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, tracing particularly the derailing of the Augustan ideals for the principate and the transformation of the princeps into a open autocrat, even on occasions into a tyrant. His work is invaluable, but it's unfortunately not complete. We lack, for instance, most of the years 28 through to 33 AD. We lack also his entire account of the reign of Gaius Caligula, which would have been invaluable, And we also lack the end of the dynasty with the death of Nero, the overthrow of Nero in the Narmi Rebellion. So some key moments in the history of the dynasty are missing from Tacitus' annals, but nonetheless, he does represent a major and very important source and allows us to document the events of the reign with a high degree of accuracy. Where Tacitus is missing, and even where he is extant, he can be supplemented through the writings of the biographer Suetonius, who was a contemporary of Tacitus's, an equestrian, a knight working in the imperial service. He had access to imperial archives and wrote a series of racy biographies called the 12 Caesars, beginning with Julius Caesar and ending with the last of the Flavian emperors, Domitian. These are very interesting documents, but as historical sources, they're somewhat more dubious. It's more like tabloid history. He goes always for the sensational, the racy, and the exciting, wherever possible. And also he arranges his biographies not in chronological form, but in thematic form. He'll discuss, for instance, the physical appearance of the emperor, good deeds, bad deeds, treatment of family, drinking habits, sexual proclivities, and so forth, in themes. And so you get snippets of information that aren't necessarily presented to you in a chronological format, but rather in a thematic format, which can make them very hard sometimes. It can make it very hard for us to place these incidents in the definite context within the reign of every emperor. And worth mentioning, as an aside, are the supplementary sources of Cassius Dio, whose Great History of Rome, written at the end of the 2nd, early 3rd century AD, covers this period as well. And the writings, especially for the fall and death of Caligula and the rise of Claudius, the writings of the Jewish writer Josephus, who wrote in Greek in the 70s AD, and wrote an account of Jewish history, but incorporated elements of events in Rome where they pertained to the history of the Jewish people. So our sources then are quite full, and along, of course, with coins and inscriptions, our sources are very full, in fact, for the Julio-Claudian period and allow us to present something of a detailed history for this dynasty that's often very difficult to do for other imperial dynasties. The Julio-Claudian dynasty stretched from AD 14, the death of Augustus on the 19th of August of that year, through to AD 68, the summer of that year, with the toppling of Nero and the end of the dynasty with that event. Four emperors reigned in this period: Tiberius from AD 14 to 37. He was Augustus's stepson and adopted as Augustus's son in AD 4. Comes across to us as a rather depressive type of character. He'd been waiting in the wings for some 54 years by the time he finally came to power. So he was middle-aged and beyond when he finally assumed all the burdens of office. We hear that the transfer of power to Tiberius, which took place on the 18th of September AD 14, was a very awkward business. Unsurprisingly, since this was the first time it had ever happened, the first time that there was to be a transfer of power from one princeps to the next. Tiberius, it seems, on this occasion, tried to emulate the tact of Augustus by trying to refuse the offices that were being voted to him. But he botched the performance and came across as obdurate and unhelpful in his dealings with the senators, who finally had to force the imperial powers upon him, and that set the stage for rather unpleasant relations between Tiberius and the Senate for the rest of his reign. He's reported to have said on one occasion whilst leaving the Senate, "Oh, those men are men fit to be slaves." So he didn't have the highest respect for them, and much of his reign is marked by tensions between himself and the Senate. We'll examine in a bit more detail in a minute a particularly illustrative incident from the reign of Tiberius that indicates to us the derailing of the Augustan principate and its transformation into something more autocratic, more openly autocratic than it had been originally conceived. Tiberius then died in AD 37, March of that year, and was replaced by his great-nephew, the young, untried, totally untried prince known as Gaius, who's come down to us by his nickname Caligula, Little Boots, a name given to him by the soldiers of a camp in Germany where he spent part of his youth with his parents. No one, of course, in the right mind would have addressed the emperor as Little Boots to his face, but that's how he's known to us and to posterity predominantly. And his reign was absolutely catastrophic. He reigned for 4 years. The stories about him are legion. And the general consensus of many is that the man was deranged, possibly suffering from some illness. Many doctors have tried to diagnose him with physical or mental illnesses, even from a distance of some 2,000 years, seems to me a rather fruitless endeavor. But whatever the case, his reign was certainly catastrophic. He may have just been corrupted by the absolute nature of his power. He was, as I mentioned, he was a completely untried man. He had never had any serious administrative position before being given the emperorship. And so he may have just realized that here he was, a young man in his mid-twenties, in complete control of the then known world, and no one was going to say no to anything that he suggested, and he went off on his own track. The result of his wild and unpredictable, capricious behavior was that he was the first emperor to be assassinated by members of his own guard, and we will examine, as the second of our illustrative incidents, we will examine the assassination of Caligula and the events that followed immediately afterwards, which are very illustrative as well, of the nature of imperial power, as we examined it in previous lectures on Augustus. Caligula was followed by his uncle Claudius, also an untried figure, a prince who came to power by virtue of the assassination of Caligula. His hand in that deed is a matter of some debate. But unlike Caligula, Claudius was not a young man. He was a middle-aged man when he came to power. And he was also well-schooled. He had been pushed into the background by his family because he had some physical defect. He limped and stuttered and twitched and drooled. And his family assumed that his physical defects were reflective of mental defects, and they kept him very much out of the public eye as an embarrassment. And Claudius devoted his time to the study of Roman history and Roman institutions. So when he came to power, he at least had a thorough theoretical knowledge of how the state should be governed, unlike Caligula, who was completely untried when he came to power. And so he ruled relatively effectively for the duration of his reign, 41 through 54, before succumbing, we hear, to assassination by his niece and then wife, Agrippina the Younger, to make way for her son, known to us as Nero. Nero then ruled, coming to power as a mere teenager. He ruled from 54 through 68 and was the last of the Julio-Claudian emperors. His reign also presented to us as an unmitigated disaster in the sources. He was largely disinterested in matters pertaining to the military and the administration of the empire. He spent his time, if we believe the sources, writing bad poetry and forcing people to listen to it. We hear that he would hold special events in the theatre, lock all the doors of the theatre, post guards around the side, and if people tried to leave, they would be prevented, senators apparently, pretending to die in order to escape from these performances. These are the stories that we hear of Nero's behaviour, but certainly he showed himself totally disinterested in the actual running of the empire, and he gradually alienated himself, not just from the Senate and the aristocracy, but also from the military basis that was the foundation of the emperor's position. And that, in fact, will be the subject of our third illustrative event from the Julio-Claudian history. So that, so much then, in outline, is the shape of events in the Julio-Claudian period. So let's now focus a bit more closely on our three incidents. First of all, the career and demise of the prefect of the Praetorian Guard, Sejanus, under the Emperor Tiberius between the years 23 and 31. The Praetorian Guard had been created by Augustus as a sort of dress guard, dress unit, that were partly a bodyguard for the Emperor, but more an insurance, I suppose, against conspiracy in the city of Rome itself. As I mentioned before, the main legions of Rome under Augustus were stationed at the frontiers of the empire, far from the city of Rome, far from Italy. But all around Rome, Augustus stationed units of troops that came to be called the Praetorian Guard. Augustus was quite careful and discreet in his billeting of these troops in small towns around the city in smaller units. But under Tiberius, they came to be grouped together into a single camp, the remains of which are still visible in Rome today, on the outskirts of the city. This presented a body of troops numbering perhaps 9,000 men right in the city of Rome itself. Therefore, the commander of that body of troops would be a person of some importance. The commander, by tradition, was a knight, a person of equestrian status, and following the death of Augustus and the accession of Tiberius, the commander of that body of troops was Lucius Aelius Sejanus, a man from a small town in Etruria, who had some links with the imperial family through his service prior to AD 16 or so, when he assumed the command of the Praetorian Guard. Sejanus's first intrusion into politics, so far as we can tell, was the murder of Tiberius's son, Drusus, who was at that time looking like he was going to succeed the emperor if anything should happen to Tiberius. So, in other words, the issue that allowed Sejanus a basis for action was the succession. And Sejanus's career is a perfect example of the instability engendered at the heart of Roman power by the problem of the succession. We don't need to trace in great detail all the events of Sejanus's career, but we hear that he seduced an imperial princess, who was the wife, in fact, of Drusus, then orchestrated Drusus's poisoning with the assistance of his wife, and then began to fill Tiberius's ear with vitriol against another leading imperial household within the imperial house, the family of Germanicus, who looked like they were going to provide the empire with future emperors. Sejanus, it seems his method was to present himself to the rather depressive and reclusive Tiberius as his friend and the guardian of his interests. Using the confidence that he gained of the emperor, he began to, as I say, undermine the position of the house of Germanicus and have members of the household and their friends and families attacked in the courts on charges of treason. This is a very subtle method of attack, and no doubt there is some basis to Sejanus's behaviour, since, as we've seen, imperial princes and princesses would gather around them bodies of supporters in the belief that they would one day produce future emperors. So the succession problem then is at the root of Sejanus's success. Without it, he would never have reached the heights that he did. In AD 26, Sejanus pulled something of a coup in persuading Tiberius to withdraw from Rome. Tiberius hated the city of Rome itself, and Sejanus, it seems, was instrumental in convincing the emperor to withdraw to the more pleasant environment of Campania around the Bay of Naples, and eventually in AD 27 to leave the mainland altogether and set up house in the Villa of Jupiter, as it's called, on the island, the beautiful island of Capri in the Bay of Naples. The remains of Tiberius's villa on the island of Capri are still visible for those who wish to visit them. But from AD 27 until his death, Tiberius remained on Capri, occasionally visiting the mainland, but never again returning to the city of Rome. Now, while Sejanus was in charge of the Praetorian Guard in Rome and was the closest friend of Tiberius alive, having the emperor secluded like this on an island gave Sejanus tremendous power. He now was the channel through which all access to the emperor had to go. We hear, in fact, from the sources that many considered Sejanus to be virtually emperor himself, while Tiberius appeared nothing more than an island ruler, a small island despot. And the real imperial power seemed to lie with Sejanus himself. And basically, from AD 27 to his fall in AD 31, Sejanus was virtually the emperor of the Roman world. He continued to orchestrate the downfall of his enemies in the house of Germanicus, and his goal seems to have been to establish himself with Tiberius in a position analogous to that which Agrippa had enjoyed under Augustus. An outsider who was brought into the family as a friend and servant, married to an imperial princess, and eventually designated as the next emperor. That seems to have been Sejanus's goals. By AD 31, he had largely succeeded by all accounts. He was, in fact, betrothed to the princess with whom he'd had a long-standing affair. He was the fellow consul with Tiberius in the year AD 31, that a particular honour reserved usually for people who were going to be the next emperor. He received a grant of proconsular power in the year AD 31. All he lacked to be designated as the next emperor was a grant of tribunician power. And then everything went horribly wrong. Precisely why, we don't know. For whatever reason, Tiberius, in October of AD 31, turned on his friend and ally and colleague. He may have found out about the murder of Drusus in AD 23, He may have found out about the extent of Sejanus' duplicity and his plotting against members of the imperial house. Well, whatever the case, in what we hear was a long and windy letter to the Senate from Capri. Tiberius, first of all, praised Sejanus, and then suddenly, at the end of the letter, ordered his arrest and execution. Sejanus was dragged off to prison and killed that night. His entire family were slaughtered, and all his friends and associates were hunted down in a witch hunt that lasted 2 years and resulted in the deaths of dozens of people. The career of Sejanus, then, illustrative of several features of the principate, the dangers of getting too close to the imperial power, of displaying overt ambition when one was a subordinate of the emperor, and above all of meddling in the problem of the succession, of an outsider trying to insinuate himself into the imperial house, all of this due to the uncertainty of the method of succession as established by Augustus during his reign. The next major incident that we should look at, which reveals something to the observer of the true nature of the imperial power, was the murder of Gaius and the accession of Claudius on the 24th and 25th of January, AD 41. Gaius, who had behaved atrociously to the majority of his reign, had taken, we hear, to repeatedly mocking members of his imperial guard, assigning them obscene passwords and watchwords for the night and so forth. And finally, they'd had enough. It's quite interesting that the conspiracy against Gaius hasn't come down to us as a broad-based senatorial conspiracy, but rather the result of personal grudges on the part of certain members of his own bodyguard, who finally, when Gaius was watching some games on the afternoon of the 24th of January, AD 41, and then left for lunch, isolated him in a remote corridor of the palace and cut him down, assassinating him. Gaius was, of course, far too young to have made any serious arrangements for the succession, and the situation, as a result, was quite difficult. Gaius had been murdered, pandemonium ensued, the guards went looting in the palace, and the most famous story for what happened next is that one of the guardsmen, a man called Gratus, we hear, while he was looting the palace, saw some feet sticking out from underneath a curtain, pulled the curtain back to find Gaius's old uncle Claudius behind the curtain, and on the spot, himself and his colleagues declared Claudius their new emperor. That's the most famous story in which Claudius is happened upon by accident, hiding, fearing for his life in the wake of Gaius Caligula's murder, and he is presented in that account as an entirely passive partner in his own accession. Of course, he is not in any way, in our sources, implicated in taking part in any conspiracy against Gaius Caligula. That's a matter for modern scholars to argue over. A slightly different version is given in our accounts. Remember, we are relying mostly now on our secondary sources, such as Suetonius and Josephus, since Tacitus does not survive at this point. But Josephus gives a fairly full account of these events, and his picture is somewhat different. He portrays the Praetorian Guard as gathering in the camp once word of Gaius's assassination had become general knowledge. They argue about what to do and decide that they must have an emperor. Without an emperor, there's going to be no imperial guard. They'll be out of quite a cushy job. So they send out a party of soldiers to go look for somebody. And it's a rather more purposeful event. Here there are guards looking for somebody to have as emperor. They find Claudius, and he's then proclaimed as their emperor, taken to their camp for safety, and proclaimed as their emperor. Now, while all this was going on, the Senate had met to discuss what was going to happen next. The meeting is interesting because it shows us just how dead at this stage the Republic was. At first there was talk of having an end to the Caesars. Caligula had been more than enough for everybody. Maybe it was time to return to the free Republic. But then senators began to propose themselves as new emperors. Maybe it's best if we keep the principate, but I'd make quite a good emperor. And in fact, and then another senator saying, well, actually, if he can be emperor, so can I. But, of course, while all that is going on and the Senate is failing to come to any decision, the Praetorian Guard, the soldiers, have made their decision and their choice, and that is Claudius. On the night of the 24th into the 25th of January, tense negotiations take place between Claudius, now firmly ensconced in the Praetorian camp, and the Senate in the Forum. The Senate count up what their military support is. They have a few cohorts of troops available to them. And it looks like they were about to defend themselves and fight off the claim of Claudius when all of a sudden all their military support evaporated and declared for Claudius. Probably because Claudius had just issued a